And the essence of this teaching has to do with, I guess you could call it, the reality of things as they are. And this is called supramundane knowledge. Supramundane knowledge. In other words, as opposed to mundane knowledge. Now, mundane knowledge, how we live in the world, you know, what are the parameters, if you will, of wisdom and knowledge that allow us to live in the conventional world, everyday world, in a way to facilitate wisdom, facilitate equanimity, peace, compassion, and understanding, and not suffer, not be caught up in the web of greed, hatred, and delusion. So, and that has to do with, you know, a deep sort of fundamental understanding of karma, how karma works through our lives, how we understand karma, and how we are able to move with the flow of karma as karma moves through our lives, or as our lives are an expression of karma as they move through us and into the world. And karma just means cause and effect. Karma doesn't mean inevitable fate or anything like that. It's how the pattern of cause and effect plays out through our life. So this is sort of called the law of karma. Now, supramundane wisdom has to do with seeing the ultimate essence of things as they truly are, beyond beyond the realities of the conventional world, as it were. It revolves around two factors. One is called the five aggregates. These are called the five aggregates of clinging. Now, what these five aggregates describe is the totality of who we are. Now, the second part that melds into this is what are called the three characteristics of existence. Now, so what are the three characteristics of all of these five aggregates? You know, for us to understand them as they truly are, what are these characteristics that characterize these five aggregates? And the first one is impermanence. The second one is non-self. Non-self. And the third is suffering. Now, to explain it in really, really simple terms, you know, basically, this whole corpus, this whole group of five aggregates is impermanent. Everything is arising and passing away constantly. You know, we're a process in motion. You know, we're a process in process. Right? And because we're this process, there's no real permanent, immutable, tangible, objective thing here. It's all a process. Even our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, even our consciousness itself is a process. So it's a fluid process. There's no thing here. There's no thing here. There's no permanent body. Even this body is a process, right? Even the thoughts I have are processes that flow through the brain. You know, every thought, emotion, every act of awareness is a process. So there's no self, there's no tangible, immutable self, you know, involved in this. It's a process. We are psychophysical processes. Okay. Now, I'll get into this a little bit more deeply in terms of, you know, explaining what that is. However, we tend to think that there's a person in this whole, you know, in this whole scenario, right? So we think there's a self there, right? That self is me, right? The self is you, you know, this person who I think I am. So we have this mistaken view of the reality of this process, thinking that there's a self here, and so we tend to cling on to it, we hold on to it, we try to protect it, we try to feed it, we try to make it beautiful, we try to keep it the same way it is all the time. But it's holding on to an illusion. And that holding on, that clinging, is what causes suffering. So the three characteristics basically describe the human condition. So in a way, that's the kind of simple version of what the three characteristics, you know, purport to say. Now, and the question here is, okay, if I'm not a self, right, if there's no self here, what is here? What is it that I think I am? You know, how do I think that I'm a self? Now, and this is really important because in the classical Buddhist teachings, the way it's articulated is really in terms of non-self. And what I want to do is share a classic sort of reading. These are from the sutras. And this is a quote from the Buddha, and this is how it's articulated in the classical teachings. Therefore, whatsoever there is of corporeality, of feeling, of perception, of mental formations, of consciousness, whether past, present, or future, one's own or external, gross or subtle, lofty or low, far or near, of this one should understand according to reality and true wisdom. This does not belong to me. This am I not. This is not myself. These are the words of the Buddha. This is not myself. And it's sort of, there's this one powerful, you know, sort of chicken skin kind of sutra. Whenever I read it, I kind of get chicken skin. It goes like this. Mere suffering exists. No sufferer is found. The deed is, but no doer of the deed is there. Nirvana is, but not the man that enters it. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. So this is pretty unmistakable. I mean, you know, the Buddha was very clear. There ain't no self. And, you know, Buddhist philosophers and, you know, philosophers for 2,500 years have argued, exegesized, and, you know, kind of contemplated, you know, what this all means. But now, with the help of modern neuroscience, we're beginning to actually come to understand what this means. And in fact, he was absolutely correct. There is no self, okay? And that is in the sense that modern neuroscience, you know, looking at consciousness, looking at self, looking, you know, trying to actually define a sense of self that exists within this, you know, mind and body complex, that there is no stable, immortal, concrete, objective self, but that it's really a complex of processes that are going on in the body and in the mind. Now, one of the most powerful explanations of it was given by a person by the name of Antonio Damasio, a very famous neurobiologist, and I'm going to summarize it really, really quickly. And that was that when we experience the environment, you know, through hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, you know, when a signal comes in from the environment, we see something, immediately what gets triggered is our memory banks. And so what happens is that, you know, we get these visual mappings, these visual sort of iconographic or sort of schematic maps arise from the visual cortex or the deeper parts of the brain that overlay, you know, sort of, if I smell a smell, oh, that reminds me of a smell, you know, like I might have smelled when I was a child, or, you know, like it kind of associates with a smell that came that I smelled, you know, before, and then the visualization of that smell, I think about what that was that comes into the mind, and then it comes in with another map, and another, you know, so these associations start to overlay, and they're basically, it's a visual mapping system that starts to overlay, and then all of a sudden something clicks and says, oh, that's, you know, that's this or that's that, right? You know, it comes to the mind, and you recognize what the smell is. Now that recognition, and then of course there's, well, do I, you know, it's always, it horrible, right? Oh, it smells great, I like it, you know. So all the characteristics of it start to unfold in terms of how we relate to the perception that we have. You know, we either we like it or we don't like it, or, you know, all of this happens. But all of this happens through these layers and layers of what are called visual maps that get called forward from our memories. And as these get called forward, there's actually a physical sense of a kind of coherence of these maps coming together. So it feels like there's someone who's actually perceiving it, because all of these maps are coming together in a certain way. So in the mind, it feels like there's someone who's feeling it. But it's actually this complex process of mapping that allows the mind to, you know, recognize what we're perceiving. And this happens in everything, you know, smell, taste, touch. So the brain is constantly processing. And so as we process reality, there's a kind of sense that there's someone in there who's processing it, but it's because of the way these visual maps are coming together that give us a feeling that there's a sense, there's a self there. But in fact, it's just this process. You see what I'm saying? So the self, or what we think is the self, is actually an illusion. It's not a real thing. Okay, so this is the illusion of self. That we think we are, but in reality is not even there. So we spend our entire lives, right, beautifying, feeding, you know, aggrandizing, protecting, defending, right, this self that we think we are. But in fact, there's no self there. So this is, you know, talk about delusion that comes from the illusion of thinking that there's a self there. Now, this is the whole crux of the teaching of reality in terms of what it actually is. So this everything flows from this in the sense of understanding that all reality is a process. There is no thing anywhere. Now you say, well, that doesn't make sense. And I look around, I see all kinds of things, right? But what you're seeing are objects in flux. You are an object in flux. You know, a leaf of grass is an object in flux. A tree is an object in flux. Even this building is an object in flux. You know, but what's different are the time frames. Some time frames are very short, you know, seconds and minutes. Some time frames are centuries and eons. The earth is in flux. The universe is in flux. Even though we see objects, what we're seeing are processes of change over time. And we are a process of change over time. So this is the meaning of anatta. This is what non-self means. You know, it's sort of explained in a kind of scientific, sort of quasi-scientific way. Now, what I wanted to do today was to bring that understanding home a little bit more and get into how the meditative practice begins to allow this to sort of come into our experience more than just in terms of conceptual awareness, but something that we can actually experience through the meditative practice itself. Now, the thing about this notion of, I mean, I really want to encourage you, or, you know, to ask you to sort of see yourself, okay, having said what I've said, see yourself as a biophysical process, right? See yourself. Think about yourself. I'm sitting here. I'm a biophysical process. I don't think that's that difficult to comprehend. I mean, you think of the blood, your metabolism, your heartbeat, you know, your fingernails are growing, you know, your cells are dividing, and, you know, blood is flowing through the body. I mean, nothing is static. It's all dynamic. We're sitting here still, but the whole body is this whole dynamic, you know, biological process, right? That's pumping and pushing and shoving and flowing, and all kinds of things are going on, even though we're just sitting still. But if we are just these this biophysical process, what are we, you know? What are my thoughts? What are my emotions? What are my feelings, my sensations, you know? What is all that stuff that's going on if it's not a self, you know, if it's just a kind of psychological process? And in essence, you know, I started to think about this, and, you know, this is my kind of take on it in terms of my personal sort of kind of understanding or attempt to sort of articulate this understanding, is that we are essentially kind of bio-organic containers. Okay, we're a bio-organic container. You know, we're, this body is a container. It contains the organs, it contains our bones and skin, and it also contains our brain, you know, which is the home of all our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions. So it contains all of the processes that are going on in the body. And what happens as we respond to the environment, okay, so environmental stimuli are coming, you know, into the body through our eyes, our nose, our ears, you know, sounds, people talking, you know, and we perceive reality, right? And this is kind of taking the Damasio kind of analogy. How we respond to these signals, say taste, or touch, or smell, or sight, okay? How we respond, you know, how we react to whatever information is coming in is conditioned by our karma, right? Because, you know, talking about the Damasio kind of explanation of these visual maps, all these visual maps come from our memory. And what is our memory but our recollection of all the things that happened in our lives, right? And what is that but karma? Because that's the cause and effect, you know, that we were conditioned in, that we were educated in, that we were taught as we were children all the way up to, you know, our adulthood. So our conditioning process conditions how we respond to the information that's coming in from the environment. So the container is the body. The thoughts, the feelings, the emotions are what's going on inside the body, and that's meeting the information that's coming from the environment. Now, that information could be somebody yelling at you, screaming at you, calling you a son of a bitch, or it could be a piece of food that you're tasting, or it could be, you know, driving a car or hearing a sound, which is pleasant or unpleasant, or tasting a bit of food, or feeling pain in the body. You know, all the things that we experience, that's information coming in from the environment, and how we respond, you know, whether it's by liking or disliking, or, you know, pleasant or unpleasant, is conditioned by, you know, how we've been patterned, how we've been trained, how we've been, you know, sort of programmed, you know, by our conditioning. You know, okay, now bear with me, okay, some people might be kind of thinking, oh, we're just some biomechanism, right? But bear with me on this. If you can see yourself as this process, right, of interface with the environment, responding through, you know, emotions, thoughts, reactions, liking, disliking, all the things that are going on, whether good or bad. Now, this can go in two ways, right? We can respond in ways that lead to suffering, unskillful behavior, you know, and unwholesome behavior, or we can respond in ways that lead, that are wise, that lead to wisdom, compassion, loving kindness, and peace. You see what I'm saying? So it's how we respond to this environmental information that determines whether we live in suffering or whether we live in peace, loving kindness, and equanimity. But having said that, if you can see yourself as this process and not be so identified, you know, for the moment, just say, okay, I'll accept provisionally the fact that there's no self there, that I am this process, that all the emotions, all the feelings, all the, you know, the reactions that I have to the environment are, karmically determined responses to, you know, to inputs from the environment. And I'm just kind of going along like this, and all this is happening, and my whole behavior is constituted of this interaction between my conditioned responses and the environmental information. Right? So you're seeing yourself literally as a biomorphic machine. To me, it allows me to kind of step back and say, oh, okay, I can watch this. Because it is a biomorphic machine, I'm not so identified with it anymore. It's not my feelings or my liking or my disliking or my thinking it's right or my thinking it's wrong. You see what I'm saying? In other words, we're pulling away and we're not identified with how we respond to the environment. We're just seeing the responses as they're arising with a kind of spacious clarity, which is called mindfulness. So we step back and we see are the responses that we get, you know, that we embody to the environment in a very clear, spacious, dispassionate way, which is exactly the way Joseph was describing it, right? That is mindfulness. We say, okay, for a moment, I'm going to say, I'm not identified. It's just the stuff that's coming out of me in terms of how I respond to the environment, and simply observe it. So is it a response that's angry, vengeful, you know, stressed out, you know, self-deprecating, right? I mean, you know, just be honest with yourself. I mean, what kind of response are you giving to, you know, signals from the environment? Or are you giving, you know, responses that are understanding, wise, spacious, generous, you know, compassionate? It's just that capacity to step back and see how your conditioning sort of programs how you respond to the environment. And that includes everything. That includes the food you eat, the people you talk to in the street, you know, your relationships, your husband, your wife, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, you know, the people at work. That's all the information that's getting, you know, that's all the stuff that's coming in from the environment, right? And some of it can cause anger, some of it can cause depression, some of it can cause, you know, happiness, some of it can cause, you know, embarrassment, guilt, right? I mean, that's the stuff that's coming in. And can you observe your conditioned responses with that kind of clarity? You know, sort of almost pretending, okay, so there's no self, let me just watch what's going on and see what's unfolding. This is what the mindfulness is. This is how we start to see our suffering. This is how we see when we're hooked, right, by wanting something, expecting something, or not wanting something, or being averse to something. You know, as soon as we get triggered, you know, these are what we call triggering kinds of emotions that trigger us because, you know, we're not getting what we want in some way. That's what suffering is. Every time you're triggered, that's a form of suffering because you're not getting, you know, what you want. So I think that that's a really, you know, it's a great model, you know, in terms of seeing this body as this bio kind of organic container that confronts the environment, confronts the information that's flowing from the environment through our conditioned responses. And if you understand that all your responses are conditioned, you know, this allows you to begin to understand a little bit about, well, are those conditioned responses leading to unwholesome, unskillful behavior and greater suffering? You know, or are they leading to, you know, wisdom, compassion, generosity, you know, and more skillful outcomes? And this is where that analysis, this is where that sense of clear seeing allows you to make wise choices, so that your life unfolds in a more skillful, unwholesome direction as opposed to unskillful, unwholesome direction. So, you know, this is really a crucial aspect of seeing, you know, an application of the concept of non-self, because actually, this is actually what we are. We are these bio-organic processing mechanisms, and we process information from the environment all the time, based on how we're conditioned. Now, this is basic Buddhist teaching. Now, one of the things that also became obvious to me as I sort of considered this, you know, kind of possibility, is that our whole life process, you know, if we see our life process that way, you know, from birth to death, and this whole phenomena, you know, that we are, which is what, which is our body, our mind, our life, you know, that goes from birth to, you know, to growth, to maturation, to aging and decline and eventual death, you start to see it as this ephemeral, beautiful spark of life and consciousness, you know, in the world that comes into life and it reaches this beautiful fruition and then it passes away. I mean, it's this process, and we're this process that's part of the process of all life. You know, we become part of what is called, you know, the cycle of life. And yet, and it's impermanent, it's ephemeral, but it's a miracle. It's an absolute miracle that we are in this life. We have this consciousness. We have this ability to feel, touch, smell, taste, think. And yet we end up in suffering. You see what I'm saying? What a bloody waste. Why can't we blossom, you know, in the fullness of our beauty and the gifts that we have in the world? Because we're only here for a short time. Why do we have to spend that time getting pissed off because I don't have a BMW or a Mercedes, or I don't have a house on Wailiki Ridge, or I'm pissed off at so-and-so because he has this and that, or I don't have this and that, and this and that, and this and that, and this and that, and this and that. And so I have to go to war with Serbia, or I have to bomb the Ukraine, or I have to kill all the Muslims, or I've got to, you know, you see what I'm saying? This is the reality that, you know, the conventional world, the world of suffering, the Ukraine, Syria, Libya, you know, it's the Sunnis and the Shiites and the Protestants and the Catholics, and that's all identification, right? It's like, my way is better than your way, and I'm going to teach you how much better my way is than yours, if you know whether you like it or not. You see what I'm saying? This is what ignorance is. This is what ignorance, and this is what suffering is. The whole Israeli-Hamas thing, out. I mean, the suffering is just so egregious. So, you know, one word is just nauseating. So unconsciously, you know, the point is, life is impermanent. Life is impermanent. It's ephemeral. We're here just for a short spark in the time frame of eternity. Just a short spark. And the irony, I mean, the irony of this whole thing is that unconsciously, I think everybody knows this. Everybody knows this. Everybody knows we're going to die. Everybody knows that this life is short. Right? So it's impermanent. Whether we acknowledge it or not, we know it's impermanent. But that leads to two results. That leads to two results. One is you hold on for dear life. Exactly. You hold on for dear life. You cling to your identity. You cling to things that make you right, things that make you feel good, things that protect who you think you are, that give you a sense of, you know, validity and stability and power and, you know, the whole sort of Darwinian, you know, kind of, you know, survival of the fittest attitude, because I want to be strong, I want to be powerful, I want to, you know, spread my gene pool, I want to, you know, this is, you know, this is coming out of fear of impermanence. Think about it. Right? People's craving for permanence comes out of the fear for impermanence. We all fear impermanence. So we live a life that denies our impermanence. We seek permanence. We seek immortality. We seek, you know, power, riches, fame, all the things that, you know, sort of validate our identity. that validate our, you know, our eternity, you know, so we become like the Donald Trumps of the world, or, you know, we aspire to, you know, what they do, right? The Donald Trump, I can't even remember all the names of the, you know, big, rich, and famous people in the world. So that's one way of living life. And pretty much 99% of the world lives life that way. But then there's another way. And that is to really recognize the impermanence of things, the ephemerality of things, and embrace it. Embrace it with joy and celebration. In other words, because it's impermanent, we try to live life to the fullest. You know, maximize, you know, the time we have on this earth in terms of what we're capable of achieving in our life, what we're capable of becoming in our life, attaining the fruition of our God-given gifts, whatever they may be, and living a life of purpose, of creativity, of fulfillment, and self-actualization. That's completely different. But it comes out of that same recognition of the ephemerality and the impermanence of life. You know that, right? So because we know that something is impermanent, we embrace it with even greater intensity and joy. So there are two different ways of seeing the world. And I think, you know, what the Buddha was saying is, you know, let's recognize impermanence. Let's work with impermanence. Because it's not going to be any different. You know, you're going to die in the same number of years. You know, whether you were, well, probably if you were suffering, you'd probably die earlier. Right? Because your body would probably, you know, not sustain that kind of stress. But the point is, we're all going to die. So if we're going to die, why don't we make the life we have as rich, as powerful, and as fulfilling as it can be? And this is the lesson. This is the lesson that comes out of the whole teaching. And it's based on anatta. Because there ain't no self. It's a process. So enjoy it. You know, like, look back and see this interaction of you and the environment, how your conditioning flows through you, you know. Come to understand it with this sense of spaciousness. And it doesn't, and as you do that, this is where transformation starts to happen. You start to change because you're no longer controlled by your conditioning. See, this is the essence of suffering, when we're controlled by our conditioning and we don't even know that. And most people are controlled by their conditioning and they don't even know it. They just act out of their conditioning, right? You know, whether you're Protestant, Catholic, Sunni, Shia, you know, that's your conditioning and that's what you do. Whether you're Jewish or you're Muslim, that's conditioning. And we just act out of it. And we can't, I mean, that's why the Jews and Hamas, you know, they just cannot get it together because they're just coming at it from their own points of view and God knows what's going to happen. You know, I watch the news and I'm just torn to shreds. You know, like, what, 800 people dead now, you know, in 3 weeks? And you look at the devastation, you know, like in Gaza, you know, Gaza City. It's unbelievable what people are doing to each other. You know, and it's all from their beliefs. Conditioning. This is what conditioning does. It causes all of that. So that's what ignorance is, right? How can we live a life? How can we live in ways that, you know, move away from that? That have more compassion, that have more spaciousness, you know, that allow us a degree of empathy, loving kindness, compassion. That's the difference. As we go through this process, you know, like seeing ourselves like, you know, as these biomorphic containers, you know, with these, you know, karmically conditioned responses to the world. As we start to see that, we actually begin to deconstruct. You know, the word, I love that word, deconstruct the feeling of self. We actually start to take it apart bit by bit and start to see, you know, how those perceptions, how, you know, my aversions or my clinging or my attachments, and we start to see it clearly. And as we start to see it clearly, it kind of gives us that spaciousness, which is part of that deconstruction process. So we see what is arising moment by moment. And then we investigate through wisdom, and we start to illuminate the momentary, fleeting, insubstantial nature of experience. I mean, these are thoughts that just rise and pass away, rise and pass away. Now, we don't give it, we don't feed it, we don't proliferate it, we just watch these thoughts rising and passing away. Now, you can do this in different ways. You can begin by focusing on a particular sensation or a particular aggregate like the body. And the obvious one is the breath, sensation, movements, changing postures, seeing how our postures are continually changing, looking at our feelings, seeing how feelings are impermanent, recognizing the quality of the experience, whether pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, highlighting its flavor and seeing how it too is in constant flux. And for example, in our last retreat, I remember as I was reading this, a memory came to mind of a person who reported in walking meditation, you know, this her perception of sensations was becoming so clear. So, you know, she could feel the wind, you know, as it brushes across her skin. She could feel the grass, the blades of grass under her feet. And she could see the beauty of the, she could almost feel the energy of the plants, you know, as she was walking. And then she made this comment, which was so, you know, it hit me really hard. As the breeze touched her skin, she could see her delight at the feeling of the breeze on her wind as it touched her skin. So it's not only the feeling of the wind as it touches her skin, but it's her reaction. She's actually seeing, and then she would look and she'd see something that was unpleasant, and she would say, oh, she could see her aversion to that as it arises and as she was perceiving that particular, you know, object. So it's seeing not only the reality of the object, the sensation, the feeling, but her response. And that's really kind of seeing your mind at a very, very, you know, kind of microcosmic level. You know, just seeing it, you know, seeing this response, seeing the feeling arising, and then seeing the response arising and then passing away. Just this continual flow, you know, of mind moments as they arise and pass away. And seeing their impermanent, ephemeral nature. So the more we experience the impermanent, fleeting nature of experience, the less we cling to them, the less we take them so seriously. You know, to be self, it's like, I'm feeling this, or I'm, you know, I like this, or I don't like that. It's just liking arising and passing away. Disliking arising, passing away. It's not being identified, just seeing it, you know, as it arises and pass away. So the wisdom lies in experiencing every moment in its fullness, but also recognizing its impermanence, and not holding on to it, clinging to it, learning how to let it go. Now, we can also pay attention to perception, you know, which is, you know, perception of six sense doors. We can begin to see how we perceive things strongly, how we perceive strongly influences how we feel about things and how we think about things. So perception is a very powerful formation to understand. Whether we perceive something positively or negatively, and how that influences our feelings about our experience. Now, so this is like watching a train of thought. Say you eat a piece of chocolate, and it's so delicious, right? It's like, oh, I love this, and you're just kind of savor that, you know, that piece of chocolate, and you feel it in the mouth, and it goes down, you know, the throat. And then you start thinking, oh, if I go to Kahala Mall, I can go to See's Chocolate. Yeah, I love See's Chocolate with the pecans and the, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then the mind starts to proliferate, right? It's like, oh, I need to get some more of that. And, oh, yeah, when I go home, I'll drop off at Kahala Mall and get a box of See's Chocolate. And then you're thinking about, well, I wonder how much it costs. Do I have my credit card with me? Oh, I forgot, you know, maybe I have enough cash in my wallet. See, the mind just kind of proliferates. And if you can observe that, you know, you see how this is dependent origination. This is becoming. This is how karma starts to unfold due to craving. So thoughts begin to unfold. Out of the thoughts come actions, right? Attachments. And before you know, you're overdosing on chocolate. So, but yeah, this is how it all unfolds, right? So observing this process as it unfolds in the mind, this is what the mindfulness allows us to do. Another example is how we tend to get lost in our thoughts. Now, I'm sure everybody does this. You just get lost in your thoughts and stories and the innumerable feelings and emotions that arise out of them. You know, you get lost in a thought, you get depressed, you get angry, or you can become happy or joyful. You know, your moods, you know, sort of follow the stories that you run through your mind. Okay, this is all mental formations, right? Watching mental formations and how these mental formations affect your emotions and how your emotions start to affect your actions. Bang, 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 bang. You see that whole train, that karmic train that ensues from your thoughts, mental formations. So we get lost in our thoughts and we don't realize that basically there's just an empty thought passing through the mind. You know, it's a thought that comes and it goes. But we invest so much in that thought and we identify with that thought and all of a sudden we give it a reality, you know, that it doesn't have. And that's how we get caught up in it, and that involvement, you know, leads to further thoughts which lead to further actions and karmic consequences. So it's observing, you know, how this process unfolds in the mind. So we really need to investigate. And this is what mindfulness is. It's this investigation. How we are controlled by our perceptions and the power that they have over us. Our perceptions, our thoughts, are incredibly powerful. Because they cause us to do so many things that can be unskillful, unwholesome. Or they can cause us to do things that are wholesome and skillful. So we need to be really aware, you know, of the power of these thoughts. Now, of course, the thing about thoughts is that they are basically the product of karmic circumstances. Every thought that we have comes out of a cause and effect process. You know, whether we like something, we don't like something, or we're angry, or we're sad, or we're feeling good or bad, it's that response is determined by our conditioning. So it's a product of, you know, karmic circumstances. So if we truly understand or examine a thought, we can start to see the causes and effects that produce that thought, whether they were wholesome or unskillful or unwholesome or skillful and wholesome. And that allows us to understand them, not to be so identified with them, and to eventually just let them go. So in other words, we begin to loosen the control that these thoughts have over us. This is what wisdom does. It allows us to let go of things and not be so controlled by what's going on in our minds. Mental formations are another object of investigation. And of course, seeing their impermanence and knowing that all of them are not self, are not me, are not mine. You know, just seeing the flow of thoughts and feelings and emotions as they move through the mind. So that's the wisdom that we want to apply to each of the, you know, of the aggregates. That's where the freedom is. So we're not just running around, you know, sort of chasing our, you know, our likes and dislikes, attached to the suffering of the world, attached to the aggregates, identified with the aggregates. You know, we're building this capacity for spaciousness and understanding. So I'd like to sort of end with a quote from the Buddha. And this was, the metaphor was based on, some of you who were here last week know the metaphor. And it comes up, let me just read it really quickly. Suppose, bhikkhus, a dog tied up on a leash was tied up to a strong post or a pillar. It would just keep on running and revolving around that same post. So too, the uninstructed worldlings regard form as self, feelings as self, perceptions, volitional formations, and consciousness as self. They just keep running around. Form, feeling, perceptions, volitional formations, and consciousness. And they keep on running and revolving around them. As they keep on running and revolving, they are not freed from them. They are not freed from birth, aging, and death. not freed from sorrow and lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair, not freed from suffering. So it ends with the Buddha saying, the instructed noble disciple comes to know form as not self, feeling as not self, perceptions as not self, volitional formations as not self, nor consciousness as self. They no longer keep running and revolving around them. As they no longer keep running around them, they are freed from them, freed from birth, aging, and death, freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair, freed from suffering. So, the whole process is about attaining a certain wisdom, a certain way of understanding reality, you know, as it truly is. And that's where the freedom is. So we're not just running around this pillar of form, feelings, perceptions, volitional formations, and consciousness attached to the suffering of the aggregates. And it also, you know, to bring it into the contemporary context, allows us to begin to really understand who we are, you know, as biophysical, psychophysical organisms, that we are processes, you know, unfolding in time and space. And I remember Tom one time sent me this incredible, incredible video of the reproduction process of the DNA, you know, when the DNA splits and how, you know, in this incredible sort of video. And the things that are going on in this body are just so incredibly miraculous. I mean, if you really sit down and look at it, you know, at the cellular level, in terms of what's happening in the body as a biophysical process, it is a miracle. It's an incredible, incredible miracle what this physical body is and what this mind is. And if we start to really appreciate it at that level, because we take it all for granted, right? It's my body, my head, my thoughts. You know, we just think. We don't think about what happens when we think, right? In terms of the actual biophysical process that's going on. You know, it's this miraculous process. So it's not about reaching out to something beyond the body, you know, sort of some celestial, you know, sort of universal kind of God or guiding voice, or, you know, it's just looking at what's here, what's in this body, as the manifestation of divine reality. This is what divine reality is. Everything here is divine reality. We don't have to go anywhere else. It's right over here. This is the ground of being. You know, in the Paul Tillich's words, this is the ground of being, right here. We don't have to look anywhere else. It's already here. And that is the life process itself. It is who we are. This is what is divine. This is what is supra-mundane. This reality of this no-self. I mean, the self that, you know, all of a sudden who we think this concrete, objective, you know, entity is, becomes, opens up into the universe, because we become part of this interactive organism, because, you know, that's what we are. We're taking information through the five sense doors 24/7 all the time, and we're constantly interacting with the environment. You know, even when we're sleeping, when we breathe, we draw in oxygen, we take out, you know, we breathe out carbon dioxide. We're hearing things, seeing things, smelling things, tasting things. We're taking in food. We're defecating. We're leaving our waste. We're urinating. You see what I'm saying? We are open systems in constant interaction with the environment. We are part of the Dharma, and the Dharma is part of us. We're part of nature. That is what the Dharma is. So we are the divine. We're part of this entire process that's moving and flowing you know, through time and space. But we don't see that. We only see this body, you know, these clothes I wear, the car I drive. You know, we see ourselves as objective entities in the world. This is what ignorance is. That's the delusion. Now, it's not bad. I mean, this is how everybody sees everybody. This is how it is. But it's not really what's actually happening. And this is where I cannot even comprehend how the Buddha could have seen this 500 BC. Right? Of course, he was probably seeing it in a different way than the neurobiologists are looking at it today. But still, to make, you know, to make the statements that he did, it's just nothing short of incredible to me. And now, of course, it's all being confirmed by modern neuroscience. So we are biophysical processes. But that's not a bad thing. See, that's the point. If we embrace it, it just creates a whole different reality. It literally creates a different reality. It's no longer protect, defend, identify, me, self, other, anymore. All of those boundaries become permeable. All of those boundaries become, you know, open. There's no self, there's no other, because we're all the same. We're all biophysical processes. All of a sudden, whatever, you know, Christian, you know, Muslim, or Shia, Sunni, all those distinctions become irrelevant. We're just human beings. We're mothers, we're fathers, we're children, we're wives, we're husbands, we're brothers, sisters, cousins, nephews, etc., etc., etc. We're human beings. And we start to relate to each other that way. So, compassion, you know, loving kindness, generosity, dana, all of a sudden become operative words. It's like compassion is not a zero-sum game in terms of my giving what I give to someone is something less than I have for myself. But it's a recognition of our structural connectedness. We're connected at the hip bone, you know, regardless of male, female, you know, culture, race, ethnicity. We're all human beings. And we're all connected at the hip bone. We're all brothers and sisters. And, you know, so it's a whole different view of the world. Because it's a whole different, because we're not caught in that sort of bastion of self, you know, that castle, that fortress of self that's defended, you know, and holds off everybody else. This paranoid bastion of the self. It just dissolves. And we become one with the larger reality around us. And out of that is, arising out of that is wisdom, knowledge, understanding, compassion, loving kindness, equanimity, and peace. This is the path to freedom. This is what freedom is, the way it's defined by the Buddha. And this is the path that's open to all of us if we come to this level of understanding and this level of practice. That's the transformative effect of this practice. That's what changes us, you know, into spiritual beings and releases us from the bonds of suffering. So thank you all very much, really, for the privilege of being able to share this wonderful, beautiful wisdom of the Buddha.